Well, it is a delight to be with you. My honor to be with a group of men who I believe more uniquely than perhaps any other group has consistently and passionately brought the gospel to people's lives. And to have the honor to be with you is immense. Bob mentioned a story, one that I will be glad to tell, and as well many others. Part what I'm asking of us, if you contrast what your women are experiencing, they have a lovely day of fellowship, internationally brilliant speakers, incredible music, free lunch, and you get me. And what I'm going to ask for you is that you would, with me, think about the issue of stories. And to do so, to think about story, to ponder the nature of story, and to think about the nature of your story, to allow your own story be present as I talk about mine and other stories. And to think about that in the context of the great story, the gospel. How do we bring our stories, many of which we have found to be too disconcerting, too difficult to face, and therefore we've isolated or erased, simply presume that what's most important is that we allow ourselves the gospel story. Many of us, if we tell any portion of our stories, we'll tell a bit about how we came to Christ, perhaps those moments of divine intervention, maybe even how we met our wives. But those are the stories we will allow to be told because it appears to have gospel meaning. It appears to have a value to be able to connect people to the gospel. What I'm going to ask of you is to be very aware that God has written your life. He has not just imbued you with a number of stories. Your life itself is a story. And we live in a culture that is story-crazed. One only need to turn on the TV to have a sense of reality TV shows. Insipid, vapid, repetitive, endlessly the same, and yet our culture craves human story. To a point where we'd rather watch your story than to indeed have our own. We're story-crazed, but we're all to some degree in a story war. Every one of us, whether we are a believer or an unbeliever, are ultimately having to ask the question, what story are we most loyal to? What story has the greatest power and greatest depth in our lives? So to ask you to begin the process, even though you would on a doctrinal statement no doubt say that the most important story in your life is the death and resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ. The question of whether your failing marriage at times becomes a more central story. Your own son's health becomes a more central story. Your own flagging and at times mediocre work in your ministry sometimes becomes a more compelling story. There are other stories that are competing with the gospel. And may we, as we think about story, think about your story, think about the gospel. Something that I cannot bring on my own is that the Spirit would be present with us to begin to link those realities. So given the fact that your wives are having a far better morning, given the fact that we deal with a very difficult topic, let me spend a few moments with us praying. Let's pray. Father, Son, Spirit, you alone can bring about change in any human heart. Literally at the drop of a word, you can bring about change in our hearts at any season that you would wish. And so what we ask of you is that you would give our hearts openness, that we would feel and sense and taste something of your goodness. May we come to be able to say as Joseph, looking back at the story of his life, and to be able to say, you meant it for evil, and God meant it for good. May we come to that paradox, Jesus, to understand what it is to be hard stressed and yet not broken. And broken but not overwhelmed. And at times overwhelmed but not lost. We ask that you would be present with each of us and accomplish things which we cannot accomplish without your presence and your goodness. We ask that all in your glorious name. Amen. Let me give you a broad outline of what we'll be looking at in our time together, and then we will jump immediately in. Four premises that will be driving much of what I want to say. The first is a very obvious premise. God has written your story. We'll look a little bit at Psalm 139, verses 15 and 16. That simply captures the fact that he knew us from the very weave of our lives in the womb of our mothers. And that there is not a day that has not been authored before we came to even live our first breath on this earth. God is the author. Therefore, he has authority over our lives and over our stories. Second premise. Our stories mark us. They shape us to be different men. We have different faces. We have different stories. And our face, our body, our story is meant to lead us into different tasks, callings, into a different way of making known God. Third point. Our lives, our stories are revelatory. To not study your own life is to miss the value of how God has weaved you so that you might uniquely reveal something about God. Each of our lives is about making God known. And there are common things we will say to others about making God known. But we'll each come to those words, we'll each come to the process marked by the way our stories have shaped us. Third point, you reveal God uniquely. And to the degree you do not love your own story, that you do not honor your own story, you will not give your own story for the sake of the story of God. Fourth point, our task, our calling, is to enter the stories of others. You cannot enter the story of another if you have not been willing to enter your own. A simple phrase that you'll hear me say again, you can take no one any further than you have chosen to go in your own life. You're to enter the stories of others as a translator of the great story, and that is his death and resurrection. Those are the four simple thoughts that we will be working with. Stories tell you where you're from. Indeed, stories tell you where you are going. And stories tell you how you uniquely are meant to traverse this path of life that you are called to live. To not know story is to not know God. To hate your story, to ignore it, to denigrate it, to distance yourself from your own story is to some degree to distance yourself from the very gospel. Bob asked me to tell that story, and I will. Unfortunately, that story, of course, is connected to another story, which is connected to another story, which is, and though it would be tiresome, unproductive to tell you the whole sequence. Nonetheless, that story that Bob asked me to tell is related to the fact that I was sitting in a music class in eighth grade, and I was staring out the window. I was staring out the window because I had no engagement with the class, as the teacher had no engagement with me. The teacher would not trouble me. I would not trouble the teacher. We had come to a truce, the teacher and I, a year prior. There's another story. Seventh grade, that is the year before, I was in this class. And the teacher had everyone in this class sing a solo. My name is Allender. There was an Allen. He went first, and I saw his humiliation. My voice is cacophonous. There is no reason for me ever to bring that noise to the hearing of anyone. So when he dropped the music sheets on my desk and said, "Stand up and sing," I looked at him politely and said, "No." He looked down and he said, "Stand up." I said, "No." He looked at me and he said, you stand up. At that point, I needed to be clear. I said, no way. He grabbed my shirt and he began to take me out of my seat. I simply cocked my fist and hit him in the chin, and he went down like music teachers are apt to do. He sent me to the principal's office. I knew the principal by name. I was kicked out of school for a week. That was on a Monday. Interesting. I was back in school at 11 o'clock, 11 a.m., Friday. This was October. I played football. I lived in Ohio. That lives because there's nothing else to do in Ohio but play football. Excuse me. I learned the rules, just as you did in your own story. If you're going to be a troublemaker, be a football player in a context where your power is that no one wants to lose the next game. And because I was a good football player, my coach made sure I was back in school at 11 a.m. because that was the only way I could be eligible to play in the game that Friday night. If you're going to hit music teachers, hit them in the fall. And he learned the rules of the game just as I learned. So by eighth grade, I'm sitting in a class, and we know not to trouble each other. I'm sitting in this class, looking out the window, when all of a sudden I feel a tap on my shoulder, and I turned around, and a scrawny little boy leaned forward, and he said to me, "Do you have a comb I can borrow?" And I looked at him. You must understand that I grew up in the 60s, where curly, kinky, wavy hair was hideous. This was the day in which women were ironing their hair to make it more attractive. I didn't own a comb. The only way I could get a brush through my hair was if it was soaking wet and it laid flat for a season, and then after a time it would explode back up, and then I would be mocked the remainder of the day. I hated my hair. And the idea that I would carry a comb, I don't know why he used the word comb, but there wouldn't be a single word in the English language, at least a noun, that he could have used that would have more provoked me to anger in that moment. I turned around and I grabbed him and I drug him across his desk and mine, and I was about to put a small little tap on his face when he began to laugh. Up to that point, I had never heard a laugh like that in my life. I'd heard laughter. I'd heard the laughter, the mockery in the locker room as older boys abused me. I'd heard the mockery in a summer camp where counselors abused me. I'd heard mockery and I'd heard laughter. But I had never heard what I experienced at that moment. It was kind. It was guileless. He was unafraid. And I remember looking in his face, saying to myself, "I can hurt you, and you're laughing." But I couldn't escape that it was a different kind of laugh than any I'd ever heard. I don't know why I did so, but I put him back. Sat in the class, don't know how many minutes passed, a few passed, class ended, we were on the way out. And as we departed, he came up behind me, tapped me on the shoulder. I turned around, and he said to me, "Would you like to come to my home after school today?" I didn't know his name. I didn't know if he knew mine. And those moments in your own life and your own story where you can look back 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, and I don't know, I have no idea in the world why at that moment, to a kid I didn't know, that I almost demolished, I said, "Okay, where do you live?" Got his address, got his name, showed up at his home. Within 1 week, we were best friends. This is eighth grade. Within the first week, we made two commitments to one another. The first was that we'd be best men in one another's weddings. Tell me what 8th grade boys are thinking about their weddings. Second commitment, and I'm grateful to say that first one has been fulfilled. Second one, that whoever died first, the other would dance on his grave. I'm grateful that that has not been fulfilled. He became my best friend and has been my best friend. If you've read any of our books, whom I'm referring to is a gentleman by the name of Trimper Longman III, Old Testament scholar, strong evangelical, brilliant man. And it was through his life and through his family that the gospel came to my shattered, broken, abused, angry, mean-spirited life. Did the gospel take hold? No, not at all. I loved his family. We were best friends. He was naive. So we'd often go out at night, even at 14, 15, 16 years of age. I'd steal a car, break into homes. He would go with me, and he'd say, "Whose home is this?" "Oh, a friend's. Did they say you could have that watch?" "Uh-huh." I am not proud of the trouble I could have gotten him in, but I heard the gospel through his family and through Tremper to a point where I knew Romans 3:23, Romans 6:23, Ephesians 2:8 and 9. I knew the Roman road. I knew the gospel, but it had no meaning for me. I mean, I knew the gospel well enough that even in college, at one point with a suicidal friend who came to me to say for the very last time, "Goodbye, because I'm going to kill myself tonight." As I began to hear about her life and about the brokenness of her life, I began to pour into her life a sense of hope, and you've got a future, and you don't have to do this. You don't have to kill yourself. And I began to find what the problem was in her life. And it was a particular man who had brought her great, great heartache and shame. Because for about 8 years prior to then, I had been involved in illicit pharmaceutical sales. I was in relationship with people who could have resolved that problem, and so I offered to have him killed. When she said that that was not a good alternative and was about at the point to say, "Goodbye, I will no longer see you," I don't know why it came to me, but I said to her, "Have you ever thought about relationship with Jesus Christ?" She looked at me and she said, "What do you mean?" So what, have you ever thought about your condition before God, that you are divided from God? There is a chasm, and you are on one side, and God is on the other. And that explained who Jesus was and what the cross was as a bridge from our own fallenness to the love of God. And I went through, again, in a way that probably would have brought great both joy and confusion to Dr. Bright. I went through the four spiritual laws with her, and I remember the moment where she said, "Well, how do I receive Jesus Christ?" And I said to her, "I want you to pray with me. Bow your head, put your hands together, close your eyes, and I'm going to say a prayer, and I want you to follow my words. It's not my words that will save you, but you speak those words in your own heart as I say them, and Jesus Christ will come to live in your heart." I prayed the prayer. She prayed with me. Remember that moment when she opened her eyes. It was somewhat terrifying. Her face had life. Where there was death, there was now life, and she became a Christian. It was at that point I said to her, "You can no longer be with me. You can't hang out with me. You can't do the things we've done. You can't do drugs with me. I'm going to take you to friends of mine who love Jesus, and then you can witness to me." So that's the larger context of when this moment came, and that is another business similar to ours came to town, and they were our competitors. And in our work, competitors, when they mean liquidation, It has a different meaning to it. And so I learned that there was a contract out for my life. I was in a small cartel with three other people. We were all sentenced to death. And for whatever reason, that moment when I realized that I could be killed at any point came to a moment where the gospel, in its passionate draw to what life could be, something in me said, I need to believe. I remember the moment walking down the street in Delaware, Ohio. As I walked down that street, I finally came to a saving faith. I don't know how you invite people to Christ, but this is the moment for me where I came to Christ. I went, fine. Fine. It's true. Whatever. I'll believe. I told my best friend. He said, now I want you to come to church. The complication, of course, was even as now a young believer, I might still be killed, and that's why I always carried my 9mm in the back of my pants. So we went to church. As we were in church, again, for someone who's pretty much off the streets, you must understand it is a strange world to come into. In some ways, the church, no matter how good it is, feels like, for those of us who have not been part of that world, like someone scripted a Broadway play, and we're in the play, but we do not know our lines, we don't know our moves, we don't know what to do. So people would stand, and I would always be 1/4 second off. People would sit, I'd still be standing. People would open up one book and know where to turn. They'd open up another book and know where to turn. People knew when to pray, when to say hello. It was just a mystery. Again, I was sitting very much in the back where I could see the back door, I could see the side doors. I knew if someone came in that would be of danger. And I was watching you. I was watching how kind you were, how well-dressed you were, how conservative you looked. It was all part of... People had these huge books with leather bound. Some had crosses on. It was an odd world to come into. But perhaps it got even odder when the man up front opened this huge book. I had a robe on, and he began talking. And even within the first minute, 2 minutes, I was bored. But I wasn't bored watching you. And so I kept watching and watching you. And every now and then, a phrase or a word would come past me, and I heard the phrase, Balaam's ass. And I remember looking up, going, I didn't know you use language like that. And he said, Balaam's ass, a few more times. And I'm thinking, I'm looking around, seeing if anyone is upset. People were taking notes. No one seemed terribly disturbed by this. Then a little while longer, he said, Balaam's ass spoke to him. I was watching you very carefully at that point to see if there were guffaws or embarrassment or I can't believe what you just said. Everyone was fine with it. Thankfully, not long after, he simply changed the language and he said, Balaam's donkey. And you know those moments where something just sort of filters together and the picture comes together and you go, oh, a donkey is tonky. I can't tell you how relieved I was. That story, in many ways, has marked me. Probably no sermon has remained in my heart more than the befuddling experience of hearing that God would even use an animal to speak his word to a man who was not yet quite ready to hear but heard. What is your story? When did you hear in your own voice a yes to someone who asked you a question that out of the blue you can now look back on 20, 30, 40, 50 years later and say, without that yes, I do not know where I would be. Without those moments that someone offered their home, their lives, their families, to let you in, to be able to get a taste of the gospel, you wouldn't be sitting in this room today without someone who translated the gospel for you. You wouldn't be sitting in this room unless someone had translated ministry to you. And I hope you're even now thinking, who is that man? Who is that woman? When was that place? What was said? What was the dialogue? It's all the nature of story to ask. Setting, context, place, people, characters, text, dialogue, plot, movement. It's all the nature of how God weaves his presence into the larger work of how he's working not only to redeem you, but to redeem those who hear and partake of your story. 4 points that we'll be looking at. First point, God has written your story. If you have your scriptures with you, we'll look at Psalm 139. And though it would be wonderful to read the whole psalm, I will sadly but break into it and bring us 2 verses. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. When I was woven together in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. Much to be said in that passage. Let me see if we can capture but a few thoughts. The first is very simple. I am not here, nor should anyone make much effort to try to explain the antinomy present in that passage. Is God the authority over all the earth? Yes, he is the creator and sustainer. It is his sovereign power that allows and brings all things to pass. And therefore, he is the author of my life and each day in it. Here's the conundrum. Is he the author of sin? Did he orchestrate and create those who abused me so that that would be part of my story? The answer is no. He is not the author of sin. How can he then be both sovereign God, but not the author of sin? And what we're left, as in any story, are inexplicable elements that at one level, we can use the phrase, make little or no sense. But what we're left with is that the scriptures are not terribly concerned with providing a theodicy, an explanation, a defense of God. In that, what he's inviting us to do is to begin to ponder, what do I do with the realities of my story that still to this day feel broken, feel ashamed, feel difficult, have no answers, have no explanation, simply drip there with some level of heartache and confusion? I say this and ask you merely to ponder it. When you, as a believer, demand of your story or someone else's that they find goodness in all dimensions, you will have brought a level of demand that no one can fulfill unless they lie and deceive and deny. There are stories in your lives that will leave you with this cry, my God, why have you forsaken me? As well, there will be stories in your life where, though there is no meaning, there is no clarity of goodness, there is no lesson you learned. I would ask of you at least to ponder this. Nothing is more offensive than that phrase to people who have lost children. Nothing is more offensive to people who have gone through the heartache of divorce. There may be truth in it, but its offering provides no solace And that is, let's look for the good. Let's look for the lessons to be learned. That trivializes the heartache of a story and does not do honor to the meaning that may eventually come to pass as we open our hearts to explore a story. He is the author of our stories, not the author of our sin. And yet, the author of our sin, the evil one, very seldom in the scriptures is the effort to differentiate. This was due to evil, this is God's part, etc. The narrative simply keeps moving with the assumption God is sovereign, he works his will. Will we enter the story and ask the hard questions that we are so apt to avoid? What I'm asking you to consider is this. If you hate your own story, you ignore or deny your own story, it cannot have an effect. It cannot but have an effect on your ability to take in the gospel story. If you have leveled the gospel so that your story is not part of it, including the stories that make little or no sense even today, then you have lost the place to be able to offer to people death through your story and life at the same time. The point I'm asking you to consider is this. Your stories are written by God, and your stories combine to more than just cumulative, additive stories. You are a story, and your face and your body is a story. My wife and I have been in many settings, perhaps most recently where this occurred. We were in Mexico with our church, building homes in Tijuana. We were coming back in a church van. As we were coming back, we were with probably about 15 people in the van. Grandparents, young children, people our age, people younger, 15 people. I was sitting three rows back, second to the window. As the guards are coming down, checking out the vehicles before we pass through customs or through passport control, my wife, pretty quiet because most people are somewhat intimidated in those settings, my wife says with a very quiet voice, "Watch what happens to my husband." People in the van are sort of looking at my wife like, what, Becky? What? She's quiet. Doesn't say another word. Customs agent comes up, says hello. Hi, where have you been? Tijuana. What were you doing? Building homes with our church, a church van. He looks at us, smiles, seems to walk away. But instead, he opens up the sliding door. He comes to the third row. He looks square in my face, and he says, "You, come here." I get out of the van. "Can I see your passport?" Handed my passport. "Where were you born? What's your name? What was your mother's name?" He asked me four or five more questions, and then he says, "Why don't you come with me?" We go to a building. I'm interrogated. Not long, but long enough that they're doing some basic search on the computer while these questions are being asked. About 5 minutes later, he smiles and says, "Thank you so very much." And I just said to him, just out of curiosity, "How out of 15 people in our van did I get picked?" He goes, "Sir, we're not allowed to say anything about that." I said, just a guess. "You didn't like my face." He smiled and he goes, "You got it." My wife has been stopped by police, so have I, for speeding. My wife gets these lovely little yellow tickets, little slap on her wrist. My wife's face brings a response of kindness, care, warmth. Second to the last time I was stopped for speeding, whenever I get stopped, not that it happens often, I take my driver's license and I take my insurance, I put them in both my hands, I put both hands out the window so that the policeman can see that I have no weapons, my hands are out. He came, took my information, took my driver's license and my insurance, and within a second had opened the door, grabbed me, pulled me out, and threw me against my car, cuffed me, and took me back. They checked to see if there were any known felons that I had, or felonies that I'd committed, and finally found nothing, and I was sent back. I asked the same question: why? Why that kind of care? He looked at me and he said, "I didn't like your face. I don't have a face that brings peace." Do you know what kind of face you have? Because your face and your body was woven in the womb of your mother by the great author for his purposes. Your size, your face, your disabilities, your own struggles with your own body are part of the work of coming to know how God has made you. Don't you have moments now, especially as an aging man, where you look in your mirror and you begin to see the hair that has fallen out the night before? You see the puffy cheeks that are puffier because of sleep? Tell me that there's at least one of you that has looked in the mirror and pulled your skin back to see what your skin looked like when you were younger. We all suffer to some degree, our bodies and our faces and our stories. To the degree you hate your face, to the degree you hate your body, to the degree you hate your disabilities, to the degree you hate your story, you hate God. What I want you to begin to think is that when you engage your story and come to love your story and honor your story, you'll begin to be able to use your story for the larger purposes of what God has written. Point number one, God has written your story. Point number two, your story has marked you. Your story has shaped you to be, whether you believe it or not, in the ministry. It has shaped you for how you go about the ministry. It has likely shaped you for the kind of books that you read, what you find attractive in your wife. It has shaped you for how you go about living and some of the minute ways that we would hardly ever consider ever before. I hate being late. I despise being late to anything. I have driven in a car at speeds that were unconscionable to get my children to church, where the only benefit of having gone to church that day was the fact that they probably prayed avidly on the way. There have been grave and unpleasant controversies between my wife and I because of that demand. I don't care if people know to be there a half hour after. If the invitation says 7, we're there at 7. Why? Why would that possibly be a demand? And I can justify it and say, I think it is honoring others to make sure that you be on time. And as someone who's been involved in private practice, I believe that the person's hour is important and the next hour equally. And so you don't wander in time from one hour to the next, making the person at the end of the day pay. I have all sorts of legitimate and profound ways to justify being on time. I had a dear friend I was meeting with show up at my door probably 40 minutes late, and she looked absolutely disheveled when she appeared at my door. And I said to her, "Are you okay?" She said, "No, I'm not okay." I said, "Well, you're late, but what's wrong?" She said, "Well," she told me a couple things, but she said, "I know I'm late and I apologize. I am so very sorry I'm late." And I said to her, "Really, for what we're doing, where we're going, I have plenty of time. I was able to do other things. No worries, no problem." She said, "No, I'm really sorry. I cannot tell you how sorry I am that I am late and I've made you late." And I said to her, "It's well, I'm fine." And she said, "I believe you, but I don't believe you." And I said, "Well, why?" Here's the phrase. She said, all your friends know, never to be late. She was reading my life. It was a reading in that moment that I wasn't too fond to see or hear. But as she was putting the mirror up to my face, she was saying, reputationally, people know, don't tick you off by being late. And I said, I know I am not well with my own heart when I'm late, but I thought I was far more gracious to you and others. She laughed. Then she did what few have ever done when facing some failure, at least in my own life. She simply asked a question that you might call therapeutic or counseling. It just is story. And what she asked was this: have you ever thought about what drives you beyond the legitimate factors? What drives you to be on time? And I looked at her and I said, no. I looked at my watch and it was like, well, we need to get going on the meeting. And I don't know how God works in your life, but there are times where he will simply begin that niggling, pulling on my sleeve. And I had a memory come waltzing across my eyes, and it was the memory of what it was like the few times that I went into public settings with my mother. My mother and my father was a baker. He worked very long, hard hours. I was an only child, and my mother had no other confederate. She had no one else to go with to parties. She had no one else to go with to gatherings, social gatherings. She had no one else to go to the symphony. The one or two times we went to the Unitarian church they attended, there was no one to go with her to that. And so I was her accompaniment. And wherever we went, we would always enter minimally 15 to 20 minutes late. And my mother, never satisfied to be unobtrusive, sit in the back, make not a scene, my mother would waltz us down the center aisle to the very front seats. And I could feel on the back of my neck the eyes of whatever group was there with a sense of irritation, their anger, their questions, and there was something in me that made the vow, if I have any control over my watch and my life, I will never walk into a place where I make a scene in front of others. What are the stories that have shaped you? I'm a teacher. That's my calling. I love to teach. Where did I begin to learn to teach? Homiletics in seminary? Absolutely not. I learned to teach when I was very, very young because my mother sat on one side of our dining room table and my father, who was a silent, quiet man, I would call him monosyllabic. To hear my father say virtually a whole sentence was a shock. 2-3 sentences, which could be considered a minor paragraph, absolutely stunning. It was not until 6 weeks before my father died that I had the privilege of being with him for 4 hours on a porch, cement porch, mid-Ohio, having a conversation where my father, perhaps because of the scepter of death over his head, began to tell me things that he had never told me before. What it was like to be in the first wave at Iwo Jima. What it was to be like in the second wave at Peleliu, where his best friend had his head blown off and his head landed in my father's lap. Stories that I had never heard. Stories that began to help me understand my shell-shocked, angry, distant, but very kind father. 6 weeks before he died, in that moment, I was able to bring to him my failures as a son and ask him for forgiveness. And he, for the first time, after I'd witnessed to him almost 20-some years prior, where I had infuriated him by the way that I had accused him and blamed him in needing the gospel, where he had shattered a wine glass in a restaurant and said, "Tell me never again about your Jesus." My father looked me in the eye and said, "And I have failed you as a father." And in those moments, to be able to say, "As you have forgiven me, Dad, and as I have been forgiven by you, my father, we have come to some peace, but you have a father that you will one day face, and likely sooner than not." And I was able to enter back into the gospel with him. And maybe, by far, one of my most precious and maybe one of my most important moments of ministry ever was to say to my father, "I long to be with you in eternity." And for him to ask, "How am I to invite Christ into my life?" And to be able to say, "Dad, you can pray this prayer with me." And for my father to have tears running down his face after he had come to know the Lord Jesus Christ was one of those, I could not believe that I would have such a privilege. But my father spoke little other than those 4 hours. In those 4 hours, I finally had a father, and it was glorious. Most all of my other life, my father was distant and would leave me to my mother. My task when I would come to a meal, my mother on one end, a very eccentric, at times absolutely crazy woman, a woman who would, in the middle of the night, take me out of bed, and we would go to New York. And there we would fly to Paris, and there we would spend 2 weeks in Paris. The craziness of what would happen within that world was beyond, at times, even the telling. So to have a very quiet monosyllabic man on one end and a very eccentric and crazy woman on the other, I had one role. And it was from 6 to 6:40. The meal ended always at 6:40. My job when I went off to school was to collect stories. I had about a 9-minute walk from my school to home. And what I would do on the way home is I would begin the process of organizing the stories of that day. Because my calling in that family was to be the family storyteller and to keep my father from having to speak and my mother from being enraged. I can recall at age 13 making the decision, I am sick of this role, this job, this task. And I made the decision I was no longer going to take that role. So I sat at the meal, didn't talk, didn't look up. My father, I could feel on the one side getting more and more and more panicky. My mother getting angrier on the other side. Before the night was over, my mother had thrown the plates at my father and I. She had eventually put her face into a plate of hot food and wept for 2 hours. And my father and I sat at the table in the midst of this insanity. And something in me at that point said, "It's not worth it. It's not worth not telling stories. We are marked by our stories. Our stories have shaped how we enter into the world." Let me give you 3 categories to ponder with regard to your own stories. All of us have known the reality that our stories follow some basic pattern. Point number 1, all our stories have some period of innocence. And what I mean by innocence is a taste of shalom, a taste of peace. Something is well in your life. And that is that point where there was no overt or clear sorrow, confusion, heartache, harm. And there are many in this room who, if you allow yourself to begin to ponder, what were my periods, times, moments, people of shalom, of innocence? You can begin to think. In fact, let me ask you to think. What are your periods of shalom? If someone were to ask me that question, I would say my grandmother. A broken woman, rheumatoid arthritis by the time of 45, barely able to walk, yet there was something in her heart that was spry, alive, engaged, witty. And I remember even as an 8 and 9 and 10-year-old boy, crawling up on her broken body in her lap and nestling against her. And though her arms were filled with arthritis, she would hold me and remember just her soothing touch on my face. If I were to think of innocence, that would be the picture for me of that. If you'll take even 10 seconds, if you have a notebook, if you have anything to write on, would you just take literally 20 seconds and write down, was there a place of shalom in your life? Was there a person of shalom? Was there a certain season of peace? Simply by putting a name, a place, a time, it will get more alive to you because you have written it down on paper. Literally, take 20 seconds. Shalom. If you allow yourself to begin to remember, will often bring back what some have referred to as nostalgia, but is often this odd interplay of something warm and sweet and sad. And the sorrow or sadness, even if not great, is simply the remembrance. She is no longer on this earth. And there is no longer a grandmother for me ever to sit on the lap of again. Which is a hint of the second part of every human story. And that is the presence of shalom shattered. In every life, there's the reality of tragedy. Where what was at peace, what was at rest, what was sweet, what had the flavor of goodness in life? There is a day. There's likely a moment. Likely a person, a place, and that context is where you entered the reality of how hard this earth is. And will you with me for a moment or two just begin to think about the nature of tragedy in your own life? Every one of us knows when our story changed. And if I were to put it this way, what are the top three experiences of death in your life? And let me give you categories of death. One is the death of being an orphan. An orphan is one who has lost his parents. But in the ancient Near East, an orphan was one who lost his father, because the father was the one who named you, the one who set, in one sense, the course of your life by not solely your one or several names, but who set the course of your life by how he named you and how he blessed you. Fathers shape their sons by how they bring words to them. How did your father name you? Hey, bud. Is that a term of endearment? I have a client whose father referred and refers to him as Booger. Hey, Booger. Maybe it is conceivable somewhere in the universe, that maybe there's some kindness to that name. But the way that name was spoken, I can promise you, the father was basically saying to his son, snot, come here. What did your father name you? Every one of us has faced parents who were sinners. Simply said, every one of us in this room has had a parent at some time fail us with what God meant to provide us through their loving, tender, and strong care. If you say that's not true, then what you claim is they're not sinners. Let me define sin so that it's a little clearer and not simply esoteric. Jesus in Matthew 5, 21 through 28 defined sin in these two ways. You lust. And lust is another word for desire gone mad. And he uses the phrase that might be hyperbolic if it were put into the mouth of anyone but Jesus. And what he says is those who lust struggle with adultery. So what I'm saying of your mother and your father as mine as well, my mother lusted after me. My father lusted after me. They filled parts of their own emptiness through me. They're adulterers, which is why they need Jesus. But the scriptures go on to say that sin involves another dimension, not mere lust, but anger. And then the word that is used, again, in our ears, likely hyperbolic, but the word that is used is the word murderer. Here is what is true of your lovely, good, and I mean this, lovely, good Christian parents. They're adulterers and murderers who to this day need as much forgiveness for their sin as the first day they came to know Christ. I'm making no accusations against you. I'm simply saying it's true about all of us. I remember the day when my daughter did something that I have as a category of hell. And that is called a piano recital. She was 8 years old. She was playing her first piece. It was in front of some 200 people. There were about 600 other children that were going to show that day. My daughter was inconveniently placed at the middle. So it meant a long time to come and a long time to stay. The moment came, I had one of those video cameras. The camera itself is about a yard by yard by yard. Then with an umbilical cord that went down to a larger unit that you carried, I walked in with this camera, and I was set for my daughter's performance. She got up to the piano, began to play. It was a very simple piece. She was playing it quite well. She got to the very middle, and her hands froze. And there was silence in the auditorium. And you, within a millisecond, could feel everyone in the audience tense. And I'm there videoing, and you can hear on the tape me doing this. You can do it. Come on. You can do it. Come on, come on, come on. You can do it. All of a sudden, she began to play again. And the audience began to rest, to relax. It was like, okay. Until they realized that rather than working her way through the rest of the piece, she began again. And now she's moving to that same spot that stymied her before, and you could feel the tension in the audience. She gets to that middle spot, and she freezes again. And the whole, I mean, the audience goes like this. Oh. Oh. She responds to what she hears as the oh. She turns to the audience and does this. Music teacher brings the music up, she scans it, finds the place that had stopped her, starts again, finishes, and then there's applause for her and she sits. And you know what the other parents are thinking. Thank God that's not my child. I wonder if they prepared her. Wonder if they did due diligence to make sure that they and she was not humiliated. You know what they're thinking. Finally, it's over. We all congregate around this table with sugar cookies that the music teacher had bought 6 months before. some kind of pink liquid that's supposed to be lemonade but is not, and so you sit around politely drinking, talking, eating, talking about and blessing the other child. Oh, what a wonderful performance. What a wonderful performance. People didn't know what to say to us. They would say, that was, well, she really finished well. One literally said, that was a great shrug. I just wanted out of there. And so after a polite amount of time, we're beginning to leave. I'm hurrying them out. And as we get out the door, I open the door, they get out, and I walk a little faster, and I'm going to the car, and I hear my 8-year-old daughter. My 8-year-old daughter with very wide open eyes, and that has been true for her since birth, say with a little voice, Daddy, why do you hate me? I turn to my daughter, as most parents, to hear the defense, might. And I said to her, honey, of course I don't hate you. Why would you say that? And she looked me in the eye and she said, because after you have not touched me, you've not looked in my face, you made no comment about my performance, and you couldn't have been more awkward before the other adults. And now you're walking in front of Mom and I and you want out. What am I to say? I'm an adulterer. I have lusted after my daughter's performance. And when she didn't do well, yes, I'm angry. Angry at my wife for not having worked harder to keep our family from being humiliated. And that she's not a gifted musician. What's wrong with her, even though I can't carry a tune and have not a musical bone in my body? Somehow, she was to carry on in a way that I cannot. I hope what you're hearing is this. Every child at some level is orphaned. It is not the literal orphan alone who is orphaned. Can you begin to name where your parents have used you for purposes that were not of God? Where they ate you and in their efforts to find fulfillment through you weren't looking at you but were dealing with their own hearts. There's loneliness, there is isolation, there's abandonment in all those moments where we are orphaned. Second category. The scriptures are very clear that tragedy comes when you're a stranger. And what is a stranger? It is one who has no longer the land, the language, the friendships, the conviviality of a world that they enjoyed before. You are now among a new people who have a new language, and you don't know the language. And they have new customs, and you never quite yet feel as if you're part of being an insider. And that experience of being a stranger who has lost land, language, and friendship is another word for this. You cannot tell me, I would not believe it for 2 seconds, that if you've been in the ministry longer than a year, that you have not known betrayal. Someone you have loved and someone you have served, someone you have given your heart to, has used that knowledge and turned against you. Perhaps they've spoken words which may have been true, but out of context are untrue. Or maybe they have used you to catapult themselves beyond your level to a higher level, and you were but a slingshot for their career. Or when it was inconvenient to be with you, they found some other group or ministry to support because it met their needs rather than the gospel. You know betrayal. You know what it is to be cast out of a community. What happens to those who are isolated and strange? The answer is very simple: abuse. If you remember in the story of Ruth, story of Boaz, he says to Ruth, stay close to my men, you're a stranger, otherwise you will be harmed. Strangers are always vulnerable. Anyone who's strange is vulnerable. Otherwise, how do we comprehend that in the deaf community, there's approximately a 90 to 92% rate of sexual abuse? Anyone who has physical disabilities is what one perpetrator called low-hanging fruit because no one will protect them. If you were a Jew in a Gentile world, as I was, we were mocked because we weren't Aryan, we weren't blonde. I had curly, kinky hair, and I lived in a world of blondes, and there was nothing I wanted more than to have long, straight, Brian Wilson Beach Boy hair. But it never happened. Do you know where you've been an alien and where you've been betrayed and where the larger world took advantage of you because you were weak and vulnerable? What happens for most aliens is that we turn hard, we become inaccessible, often we turn violent against those who have been violent against us. The tragedy is we turn others into strangers, and we have been one. Do you know those moments where you were in the in-group and then you were not? Where you were cast away, where you were betrayed? And what moment came and what oath did you make? What commitment did you make at that point to say, I will never, never feel again? One man who was brutalized by his stepfather, the only non-full child in this family, who was roughed and beaten by this man, came when he was age 9, once he was thrown against a wall, to simply say this phrase, I will never ever have tears before another human being again. No one will ever see me weak and vulnerable again. My question for you is, when did your heart become a desert? Yeah, Palm Springs, lovely place. You can water certain portions of the ground and build gorgeous homes, beautiful courses, lovely place to visit. When did your heart become a desert? When did tears dry up? Many of you have wives who would give virtually their lives for you to enter a kind of sorrow for yourself that they know, at least on this earth, they will likely never see. Because something in you dried up long ago. You will never enter their heartache. Oh, you're kind, you're sympathetic, you'll put your hand on their shoulder, you'll listen to the story. But they know, just as you know, there's some core wall in you that says, I won't break that oath. I will never weep again. Oh, movies, yeah, you're a tearful man. The Packers lose, you're a wreck. And doesn't that anomaly kill your wife? You'll weep at sports. You'll weep over a golf movie. But you've never wept over her abuse, let alone your own. Every story bears the tragedy of orphans and strangers. Third, every story has the reality of widowhood. Indeed, many of you are married, some of you are not. Those of you who still are married, your wife has not died. I understand concrete thought. I'm not a widow. A widow is you've had a loss of love where you are tongue-tied. The actual word widow in Hebrew means to be tongue-tied. Where you cannot speak. The things inside of you move you so very deeply that you cannot find even words to express the sorrow within. Where did love so break your heart that at one level you made the commitment that you would never love again? First dating, second dating, third dating relationship, the wife that left you, the girlfriend who no longer wanted to be with you. Where did you come to hate love? Where did you come in many ways to feel shame with regard to your own body? Where were you aroused and drawn to the prospect of what love could bring, and yet your own body betrayed you, or you betrayed another body, and now what you're left with is you have used and been used, and that sense of loss is so deep that you can no longer pursue love without some sense of shuddering with shame. Again, the question, where have you known what it is to be a widow? I won't ask you to take 30 seconds to think about each of those categories. I simply will ask that you, at some season of your life, will come before the living God of the universe and say, "Search me, O God. Help me know where I have come to hate my own story of being an orphan, of being a stranger, of being a widow, in a way in which it is keeping me from being the man you wish for me to be with my wife, with my children, with my friends, with my ministry, and with my community." Tragedy is the second part of our story. The third is shalom sought. First is shalom. Second, shalom shattered. The third, we are all seekers. We all are asking, knocking, seeking, because we are in this portion of our journey which could be called the plot. And if you know anything about a good story, once tragedy begins, the core of the story is our efforts to find our way home. The dilemma is every time we try to find our way home, we end up getting more and more lost. Not only more lost, but more trouble, more complexity, more confusion, more heartache. Every one of us is on the way home. The third portion of our story is where most of us are living today. It is our asking and seeking and knocking for our own redemption that God desires for our stories to be known. But the amazing part of this process is that as you know and come to know your story, you cannot help but stir the stories of others who are then part of your community of walking for a season to know redemption for yourself and for others. I said there were three parts. I'll give you a fourth, but it's less important because it's a fancy French word for sitting so long, you should have something particularly unuseful. It's the French word dénouement. D-E-N-O-U-E-M-E-N-T. Dénouement. The literary term basically means this. It's an unloosening of your story. It comes not to a final finish, everything's resolved, which tragically is how many Christians want this life to be. Though it's not an end, it's a temporary respite where things have come to an ending. Though even if it's not fully clear, fully made meaning, it has come to a point where we can rest for the night and say, it is good. Do you know those moments in your life where you have a denouement? 3 weeks before, Tremper tapped me on the shoulder in that music class. I'd come home from school. I was watching TV. And what came on was an advertisement for what was called a Tony hair straightener. I had never in my life heard the phrase, a Tony hair straightener. But as I watched what this product would do, it said it would take kinky, ugly, curly hair and turn it into blonde, straight, Brian Wilson Beach Boy hair. And even if they didn't say that, that's what I heard in their ad. Within minutes, I left my home. I walked about a half a mile. I went to a pharmacy. I went in and I began the process of looking for a Tony hair straightener. I looked. I couldn't find it. Finally, it dawned on me I was going to have to ask someone for help. I went to a clerk, and just as I was about to say, "Do you know where you have Tony hair straighteners?" it dawned on me, I'm going to ask a woman for help with something I find to be hideous. Myself, my hair, my face. And I couldn't imagine speaking those words. I couldn't imagine the laughter that might come. And so I made something up, and she pointed me elsewhere, and I kept looking and looking and finally found it. Got the product, walked to pay for it, and then it dawned on me all again. I'm going to have to hand this product to a woman who's going to see the amount, put it into the machine, ask for the money. But if she saw the product and looked at me, she was going to look at me and see, oh yeah, you need this product. I couldn't bear the thought of that happening. So instead of bringing it up to the clerk, I shoplifted it. I got it home. I hid it for 4 days in the downstairs basement, waiting to see if anyone in my family found it. No one found it. 4 days later, about 5:30 in the morning, I went downstairs, opened up the product. In it, there were two parts, a little pink bottle of goo and a pink plastic bag. To this day, I don't read directions. I certainly didn't sew at 5:30 in the morning in eighth grade. So I looked at it, it seemed pretty simple. You put the goo on your hands, put it over your head, put the pink bag over your head, shake it like shake and bake. And after a season, it would magically turn out to become the person I wanted to be. Sat there, 5-10 minutes passed. I'd sneak a look in the mirror to see if it was now straight. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. About 10 minutes in, I began to notice that there was a pink glob of goo on my shoulder. I looked over and I freaked because I realized my mother might see this stain and know what I had done. Not thinking, of course. That if the product had worked, she might have noticed. I'm in eighth grade, it's 5:30 in the morning, I'm not thinking too clearly, so all I can think to do is to take all my clothes off, my pajamas off. In eighth grade, I'm a very large boy. I'm sitting on the toilet naked with a pink bag and pink goo. Unbeknownst to me, my father heard a burglar in the basement. He came downstairs with a baseball bat. I don't know how long it took him to screw up the courage to come through the bathroom door, but eventually he came through. He knocked it down like a drug raid, came in with a baseball bat, and there he took in his eighth grade son. I looked up at my father, and the only acknowledgement of us at that moment was I tilted my head very slightly like, "I see you." He looked at me. I looked back. We gazed into each other's eyes. My guess would be for 2 minutes. You ever look in another man's face for 2 minutes? It's an eternity. My father, after 2 minutes, he never took the bat down. Slowly backed out, closed the broken door, and I suspect he went to bed. My father and I never spoke about that. ever again in our lives. Even when my father and I sat on that porch stoop for 4 hours, there were many stories we talked about, some very tearful, some very funny. That story will require eternity for us to be able to talk through. Many want to know what happened to my hair. Nothing. Freaked me out that he was there. I washed it out, went to bed, had an orange streak in my hair for a few weeks, but that was all. That story had no ending, did it? Not for 3 weeks. Because 3 weeks later, sitting in a music class, the level of hatred for my own hair that has come to the surface by this humiliating event with my father, do you understand even more now why asking for a comb would have brought me to a point of dragging him over my seat? What's a denouement? It is a temporary moment of rest in your own story where something of the goodness of the plan of God begins to dawn on you. Who arranged for that show to be seen, for me to be sitting there, to have seen it, to be sitting in a music class with a teacher I hit, with someone I didn't know, who's going to become my best friend, who's going to live out the gospel, who at the point of death is going to invite me to life? How could I have planned any of these stories? These stories are not stories that I tell. These are the stories that tell me. If you want to know my life and something about the nature of my redemption and the work that God has called me to, you can begin to see certain themes in your story. Your story is marked with themes. Have you ever taken even a few hours in your life to study your own life? To say what themes keep showing up. A theme is any pattern, repetitious pattern, that begins to dawn on you that it has in it something that God wants you to see and do. If you followed my stories, how I met my wife, how I met Larry Crabb, how I moved into counseling, how I went to seminary, how we began Marceau grad school, you would find these things commonly. My stories are odd. I don't believe I'm that good of a storyteller. I simply have odd stories. If you follow my stories, what you will find is that one of my primary gifts is shame. My story is pockmarked with shame. There are very few things I do well. The things I do moderately well, I always screw up enough that they provide new stories of shame. After a while, it began to dawn on me, why are there so many stories that keep coming back to the same basic theme, and that is shame? Maybe that's part of my task, my calling, with odd stories to talk about shame. But if you were to look at my life, what has been done to me and what I've done to others, what you would find is the word violence. Violence marks my life. What am I to do with my past? Prosecutor once looked at my life and said, "For the crimes you have committed, it would not be inaccurate to say you owe society approximately 230 years. What do I do with the fact that I have dear friends who have spent jail time for things far less than I ever did? And I've never spent a full day under an indictment in jail. Life is not fair. Mostly it's confusing. I have very little clarity about what my life is to be about. But if I'm willing to read the themes of my life, what if I'm willing to do is to read how he's marked my tragedy, for his purposes of redemption, then what might be possible is that I am to know something of how I'm to live for the future by looking at the past. Have a great 30-minute break.